It's time for Lunch Hour Reviews.
He was licking me! Lunch
Hour Reviews. This man ate till he burst.
You eating Jadis!
Speeding time. I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers. The Rance Macabre. Cutting,
cultured,
and curated.
Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of our Lunch Hour Reviews series. We've got some pretty good stuff this time around.
Yeah, we've been watching things outside of the show, things that we need to
busy,
watch.
Busy, 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 busy.
Yeah, I recently re-marathoned The Jinx that we talked about earlier last year. Oh my God, my father-in-law was in town and we watched one, we had to watch them all.
Okay, and I joked at the time that it also serves as an opportunity not to talk. And then have something very specific to talk about.
Exactly, exactly. He wasn't into it in the very first episode, and then, we just got caught up, and then you can't stop.
Right, right.
It's one of those. In the meantime, though, my husband and I have been watching Penny Dreadful.
Finally.
Yeah, so instead of watching Scream, like I had said that I was going to do.
Such a good decision.
Yeah.
Put 2017 Penny Dreadful at the front. I'm so excited about that idea, and at least, this we can control,
Yes,
the variables of our lives are pretty scattered, and this is something that we can actually commit to.
Exactly.
So, yeah, good decisions.
Yeah, I mean, slightly interrupted by It's Always Sunny because the latest season came on to Netflix, but I watched that as well.
Yeah.
I blew through that one. That's over, and I was, really sad that it was
only, 10 episodes.
They needed more. I hate that. But Penny Dreadful gives us lots of episodes. Mm. I'm past season one. I'm in the middle now of season two.
How much of our earlier conversations did you remember? I went through a specific purpose to not give away spoilers.
Yeah.
But how much of that did you remember going in?
Well, I knew that there was going to be... I don't remember any spoilers, honestly.
Okay, yeah, I didn't...
Yeah, I don't remember anything like that. I knew it was going to be a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Right.
Obviously, I'm familiar with all the characters in their own little stories.
Right, right.
That are kind of thrown into this. So I love it.
Yeah.
A lot.
Halfway through the third season, which sadly is the last season, there's some talk of bringing it back.
There's a comic book right now, though.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So that's what we have to look forward to, which is, I'm fine. I do that with Buffy.
Yeah.
When I want to know more about the universe, you just go on to the comics.
Yeah. Hers is pretty fun. Joss Whedon has gotten some pretty great writers on the Buffy books.
And a lot of the actors write for it, too.
So is that right?
Some of those guys do, yeah.
Oh, cool.
So it's very cool. But Penny Dreadful is what we're talking about. Dang.
Yes.
Showtime show. This was created and written by, solely written by John Logan, who we know from The Aviator, Any Given Sunday. Those are movies.
Yes. They are.
I never watched
Gladiator. Tim Burton, Sweeney Todd.
I watched that, yeah.
Not great.
Rango,
but...
which was excellent. The Johnny Depp
The animated
lizard.
Movie.
Yeah,
was
excellent. I did watch that and Skyfall. But a lot of the movies, honestly, I didn't.
Oh, he wrote Skyfall. That was the best of those Bonds.
I know. I love Skyfall. Right? And he's currently writing Alien Covenant. He's on that team.
That's promising.
Yeah.
The pictures they keep posting of Alien Covenant suggest that they're going back to retread the same material from the first two.
That's fine.
And I feel like Ridley Scott's kind of, why would he retread material that he's already done? They've literally set up a Ripley character holding a machine gun, wearing her same outfit and haircut. It just seems...
Oh, that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
I'm
a little
mind.
Surprised
like,
by
I'd like
Ridley
to
Scott.
See more miners coming in or more oil rig guys.
I'll be happy to get a xenomorph. That's
exactly.
All I need.
Exactly. I'm fine with that. I don't know. I'm fine with that. But John Logan's actually on the team for that.
Do you believe there is a demi-monde, Mr. Chandler? A half-world between what we know and what we fear. A place in the shadows, rarely seen but deeply felt.
Episodes 1 and 2, directed by J.A. Bayona from The Orphanage.
Yeah. And this year he put out A Monster Calls, which I haven't seen yet, but it's high on my list.
I was like, wow. There's some really great directors working with this, even though it's really being written by one person, which is so strange for a TV show.
It is and it isn't. Aaron Sorkin did a tremendous amount of work on Sports Night and The West Wing. I'm trying to think. There's some HBO guys who have a part in every single script.
Sure.
But I guess it is relatively rare for something that, like, and I remember talking about the production value on this show is so strong.
Oh my God. It looks like you're watching a movie.
It's gorgeous. Every episode is stunning to look at.
Yeah, I feel so
bad. The costume design? Holy hell.
The costumes are awesome, but it makes me feel so bad for Eva Green. And Eva Green's playing, you know, like our main character, Vanessa Ives. And they make her look like, you know, when she signed on, they were probably like, you're going to wear beautiful dresses and your hair will be beautiful and you'll look really
period
beautiful.
Period pieces, like you'll never have the opportunity to wear again.
I look great in that. And then instead they just make her look like crap every episode.
See, I'm a big enough fan of hers to think that she doesn't look that bad in the show.
They make her all crusty half the time. I feel so bad for her.
At times. But yeah, I don't know. I think she still shines through. And I think she's great in this. The character must be a lot of fun to play because she gets to do some pretty wild shit.
Crazy stuff. So it's, like I said, starring Eva Green. But then Timothy Dalton is kind of the guy who puts the team together.
Yeah.
And if this was like had an 80s movie, I would love for someone to make a montage on YouTube with like the St. Almost Fire theme song of everyone getting together. Right? Can you imagine that? Because I can, and I just wish I could make it. Maybe someone could make that for me. Timothy Dalton is playing Sir Malcolm Murray. Murray, we know from Mina Murray, who is later Mina Harker.
Okay,
so that's how we know them.
I recognize Mina as a name,
but
easily
Murray
enough.
Is the surname of Mina.
Gotcha.
So that's her dad. She goes and marries Jonathan Harker, which everyone knows is a terrible decision. Never marry Jonathan Harker,
especially
right?
when it's Keanu Reeves.
And our big bad of the first season is super evil ancient vampire.
Yeah,
we never hear Dracula. I hear there's a Renfield going to show up soon. Mm-hmm. But he hasn't shown up yet, so I'm always great. I love these Harbingers. I love seeing them.
Yeah, they've definitely, for as sexy as the show is, they have not gone that direction with their vampires. For the mm-hmm. most part, their vampires are this like, sort of ancient species that sort of co-evolved with mm-hmm. mankind. And there's like a demonic air to them.
Yeah,
and they
we
transform
do have sometimes the Klinger's Honors, the Weird Sisters, and the Brides of Dracula kind of wandering around. He has a very specific style.
I also like that they're not these like invincible, infallible creatures.
Yes.
And Timothy Dalton's been hunting his entire life, so he's actually a pretty good guy with a gun.
Right.
Enter Josh Hartnett.
And what might I do for you?
I have a need for some night work.
Oh, honey, don't we all?
I have a need for a gentleman who's comfortable with firearms and not hesitant to engage in dangerous endeavors. Was all that at all tell as well?
What do you think?
Yeah, playing Ethan Chandler, who's your cowboy. So we have an explorer, we have Vanessa Ives, your weirdo. Let's throw an American cowboy into the mix. And he is a sharpshooter cowboy.
Yeah, in the style of like the Wild Bill Hickok road shows,
right?
In which Wild Bill and people like Annie Oakley would demonstrate shooting prowess. And from what I understand, like, they were really the only proper marksmen of the day.
Yes.
Like, the people who could make a performance of it, it was enough of a uncommon skill. Most cowboys didn't carry guns to begin with, and mm-hmm. it turns out the Wild West wasn't all that nutty, but it was only these people who actually had some acuity with a handgun. And he's quite the showman.
Yeah,
he's,
I would watch
he's going
Josh
by
Hartnett
an alias too,
shit.
Right?
Yes, he is. He's Ethan Chandler. I don't think I know that yet, but I do know who he is.
Well, just in terms of being a man, you know,
he's got a past, which I figured out really quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, immediately. I was like, something tells me this guy is this way.
Was it the fake mustache?
Probably the mustache. I was like, you don't fool me, mustache. Josh Hartnett looks so, like, adorable in this, though, because his hair, he's trying to be like a Wild West guy with the long hair.
Yeah.
But it really reads as, like, early 90s skater guy.
He grows a beard about as well as I do, which is to say poorly.
It's so sad, but it's great. I like to see him, and he's doing a really great job.
Yeah, and that he's not asked to do an English accent. I do like that his character is quintessential American, And with that, like, of the era, this show takes place, like, just before the turn of the 20th century, right?
Yeah, we don't really know exactly. We're looking around 1870, 1880, as far as we can tell.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's kind of the end of an era in terms of the Wild West. And so the road show kind of makes the most sense, especially for a guy who's trying to stay under wraps and not really become a known quantity to the local authorities, as it would be.
Exactly. He meets up in the first season love interest Billy Piper, who I love seeing Billy Piper.
Yeah, yeah.
I love seeing her. She's just, like, always fun. She comes with a questionable accent that I kind of can't tolerate very much. But that's okay, you know.
I love the tragic quality to her character, that she's not – for all the misery she's experienced in her life.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, she's suffering from consumption. Like, this is all going terribly.
We know how this is going to end,
Right. And she's not – she's not allowed that darkness to consume her. She's still got, like, a sweetness that you wouldn't expect from, you know, a prostitute of the day.
Yeah. She's a prostitute with a heart of gold.
Yeah. And, you know, with enough, like, I don't know, self-loathing and whatnot, that she kind of – boundaries are important to her.
Right.
And she doesn't want the fallout of her wrecked life to sort of take anyone down with her.
She – connects us to our next person that we see, which is Dorian Gray, played by Reeve Carney, which we don't know Dorian is Dorian at first.
Right, right.
You just know this is a guy who's very extravagant. And so what I loved about the beginning was trying to figure out who everyone was.
Right, right.
Like, before they would say their names. That's what I'm sure, like, Jackson was like, please stop doing that. Because I would just, like, yell. I was like, Frankenstein! Dorian Gray! And then Jackson keeps being like, who's Dorian Gray? I was like, just read the freaking story. It's like 2 pages long. Read the story. But yeah, Reeve Carney is Dorian Gray, who I like, but I feel like they are not doing enough with him. Like, I would love to know what he does on a daily basis.
If I have this opportunity. Well, you're already in the second season halfway
He's
through.
He's given now a love interest right now that I enjoy very much.
I love that dynamic. I really do appreciate it. That said, don't expect too much from him. He's kind of one of the underused characters, underdeveloped in terms of, like, making him more interesting. That relationship is about as interesting as he gets.
Oh, really?
And later, there's another upturn. But for the most part, he is not the – you know, he's essentially eye candy.
Yeah. It kind of makes sense.
He's a very – like, androgynous, you know, the metrosexual of his day.
Right, right.
And so that plays into his sort of hedonism, I suppose.
Yeah,
that, like,
well, that's definitely a way to describe Dorian Gray. I hope that I can see his painting soon, because I've still never gotten to see it. And I would love to see how it has changed and stuff like that. My favorite part of the show, though, I think right now, is Harry Treadaway playing Dr. Frankenstein. And what he's giving, I think, is totally a pre-Peter Cushing age Dr. Frankenstein, but post the little bratty kid who's playing Peter Cushing playing Frankenstein in Curse of Frankenstein. Remember how like obnoxious that little kid is?
Right, because he's a know-it-all.
Egotistical poop, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't remember if he's an orphan by that point, but he's a rich kid.
He's
not told
no
ever.
And that's what this reminds me. This is like bridging the gap between that little kid and then when we see Peter Cushing finally become like the Frankenstein we know.
It's funny that you keep saying Peter Cushing, but as a little kid, he's just a young Frankenstein.
Right. Well, though, that little kid is doing Peter Cushing playing Frankenstein. That's like how they probably told that kid to be.
Huh. I wonder, yeah.
Oh, totally. Curse of Frankenstein. Anyway, I love him. And most of all, I'm loving Rory Kinnear playing Frankenstein's monster.
Ah, okay. Yeah, because the story begins on a point that we assume this is his first pass.
Right.
And so when he generates man and, you know, the learning process went very quick.
Yeah.
And so that probably takes you a little off guard in terms of, like, what Frankenstein story are they telling? Because, you know, if we're going with the, say, like, the 1931 adaptation, they were pretty cruel to Frankenstein, just even in their seclusion and putting him away in a dark room.
Yeah, he's just sitting in that closet.
Whereas, like, in this case, Frankenstein has a tremendous amount of empathy for who he deems Proteus, right? He picks his own name out of the book. And so you think, like, well, this is a curious direction. And then it turns out not his first try.
Yeah, which I had like begun to like Proteus. And
Yeah.
And so this is one of those, I think I'll do the dog warning. It's not, he's not a dog, but he is Frankenstein's pet, and he gets killed, and it's sad.
It happens very quick in the series. And yeah, that was fucking horrifying. That was bloody as fuck.
I did not see that coming.
This is on Showtime, we should mention. It's on Netflix now. Well, Showtime doesn't pull any punches in the way HBO, like Westworld and the like, they get pretty dark. And this is as dark as it gets because holy shit, that was quite a finale to the first episode.
Yeah, that was gruesome. The monster is my favorite part now, I think, of the story. I love him. At first, his name is Caliban from The Tempest, who is son of the devil. It's like a half-human, subhuman guy.
I know him as the X-Man. Similar.
Okay, similar. Great. Good. So that's why he chooses that name. He only learns how to be a person from watching people.
Right.
You know, and I think that's really interesting. His second name he chooses, when I finally started looking into it, the second name he chooses is John Clare.
Yeah, I didn't look into this first pass.
Yeah, I thought, I'm going to look at this. Maybe there's something interesting here. John Clare is a very cool poet. And so here's a little tiny history hour. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Drop some history on you. Do people do that? I shall. Okay, John Clare, unlike Frankenstein's monster, hated progress and he hated change.
He seemed
like a real curmudgeon. he liked nature, things like that, clearly, because it was part of the Romantic period where literature was all about, you know, nature.
The beauty of nature.
Like right. So in his prose, in his voice, he's very similar to the monster in that way. But the monster loves being this new invention instead of an old person kind of a thing.
Right.
And so this is where John Clare and Monster kind of separate. John Clare wrote during the Industrial Revolution, and here's where he gets a little crazy, and this is where it becomes a little macabre. He ends up writing tons and tons of poetry, fine. His second wife ends up putting him in a mental institution.
Oh.
Because he's a crazy, crazy drunk.
Oh, I was gonna assume syphilis of the day.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
He was, I think, pretty true to his wives, honestly. So this isn't like a Schubert kind of a thing. This is like this guy is really into his wife. However, he pulls a Shia LaBeouf one time, gets really wasted, goes to a play. The guy who's playing Shylock, he starts heckling him from the crowd because he can't help himself, apparently. He's just a real fan for Shakespeare.
Is that it, or is he an anti-Semite?
You really don't know. That's what gets him thrown for the first time into the institutions. Mm. He lives in and out of the institution for a while, then he's always there until he escapes. I don't know how he escapes.
A poet escapes the mental hospital.
He escapes the mental hospital.
Oh, and this is the age of Bedlam.
It's probably easier
than we're thinking. In Bedlam, you just kind of, you try not to shake and crap your pants, and they'll let you walk right out the front door.
Maybe that's what he did. don't shake or crap your pants. Is that all I need to do?
I'm just saying, if you want to stand out as a sane person.
I am sane. He walks out of the mental institution that he's in and walks for 90 miles to his house.
Holy hell.
But then the whole time he's fixated on finding his wife, except for that's not his wife. It was his previous wife, not his current wife.
Oh.
And so she's like, get the fuck out of here. Anyway, not romantic at all. For a romantic poet, that's not romantic. He'd be like, I walk 90 miles to see you, Mary. And she's like, my name's Patty. Like, who the hell are you?
I'm starting to think syphilis might have been a contributing factor.
Maybe. From there, then he goes into another mental institution and finishes his days there. So most of his poetry is actually written in mental institutions. And he goes to a mental institution or in like lunatic asylum, you know, as it was.
That's like street cred for poets.
Yeah, right? But he is in one of the known most humane lunatic asylums that occurred in that time, which was the beginning of humane psychology.
Oh, interesting.
So he lucked out in that way, right?
I'm not going to say too much, but in season 3, the burgeoning science of psychology does play a part. I think you're gonna dig that. It goes to some wild places, but that's kind of one of the foundations.
Yeah. So if you want to see some kind of cool poetry written in a mental institution, oh, you got to watch out though, because the stuff he wrote later in the second mental institution,
yeah,
he just starts rewriting like Byron stuff and like Keats and stuff and pretends really? Like it's his. And then he says he's Shakespeare for a while.
In his defense, he was in a mental institution.
It's true. It's true. He kind of pretends like that's who he was. He says he was Shakespeare. He's from Northamptonshire. So he writes in this very specific dialect. So if you could imagine something like Shakespeare or Keats being rewritten into a local dialect, it's kind of hilarious. It's weird, a dialect yeah. that uses words like us-ins for ourselves.
Oh, boy.
So it's fun to watch and listen for. So I think you should definitely check it out.
Cool. And that's the identity that Frankenstein's monster essentially takes up.
Yeah.
So without giving spoilers, I will say there is a Wolfman in the later parts of the series. I think one's alluded to, but I won't say who it is. I will say that the design of the werewolf is a little bit of a throwback to Werewolf of London, which is a better movie than the classic, I'm putting in quotes, Wolfman from 1941.
Yeah, you
with
hated
Lon
that.
Chaney Jr. It's not a good movie.
You
and,
hated it.
And the character design is not great. It improves over time in the sequels, but the original is not good. The transformation is not good. For anybody interested, we talked about it pretty in-depth on our Universal Monsters episode. It was number 2. But so Werewolf of London provided the sort of template of the man wolf. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just, you know, a sort of giant dog.
Right.
And that was the design that sort of spoke to the Curse of the Werewolf with Oliver Reed that Hammer produced. And again, it's a hairy dude, but the sort of stylized hair and facial features are recognizable, mm-hmm. more so than, say, the 41 werewolf, Wolfman, where... Yeah, I joked at the time that, it looks like dyed cotton balls pasted against his face.
So sad.
It's not great. But in this case, it is a throwback, and I liked it. Overall, there's some good transformation stuff later in the series. So all 3 seasons of Penny Dreadful are on Netflix streaming.
Yeah.
You should check them out. I imagine if there's enough support on Netflix, it might sort of initiate another round, maybe
it's
another
great,
season.
Though, like, yeah. I can't believe that it only got 3 seasons.
But considering how expensive it was, and that it's Showtime, it's not HBO.
I
don't think they're exactly bleeding money. So. Yeah, I would imagine it was a costly endeavor. There's a lot of like location shooting, and it's England in the like 1880s,
right?
And that doesn't
it's
come
cheap.
Though. Some of the like background effects, and it's really flawlessly done.
Yeah.
It's very cool. Okay, so next I'm going to talk about the Iranian movie Under the Shadow. Written and directed by Babak Anvari, starring Narges Rashidi, Avin Manshadi plays the daughter Dorsa, and Bobby Nadiri plays her husband. A brief synopsis before I get real long-winded. As a mother and daughter struggle to cope with the terrors of post-revolution, war-torn Tehran in the 1980s, a mysterious evil begins to haunt their home. So the story does have a lot in common with The Babadook in terms of – and I say that in a good way. I like The Babadook a lot, and this doesn't copy anything. There are just certain dynamics that are really similar. It is a story of a mother and child under tremendous stress, perhaps – okay, definitely supernatural. Where in The Babadook, the background tension stems from Amelia and Samuel never really addressing the grief of losing their respective husband and father. In Under the Shadow, that subtext that haunts their day is the Iran-Iraq War.
Okay.
So a little bit of background. This is, yes, brace yourself. I've tried to make this as interesting and concise as possible.
All right, okay.
For Iran, 1979 marked the beginning of the Islamic Revolution. Now, when I hear revolution, I kind of assume it's for a modern liberation to become more global and inclusive, but this was the opposite.
Right.
In 79, Iran was fucking bohemian. Up to that point, they were
really cool.
A very liberal Middle East
country. Yeah, time under the Shah was a very cool time in Iran.
Yeah, and as liberal as it seemed in retrospect, there were a lot of revolutionary groups, mm-hmm. some more liberal, some way more conservative, like the followers of the Ayatollah.
Right.
It was his faction of Islamic revolutionaries that dethroned the Shah.
Right.
And in his place, they put up the Grand Ayatollah Khomeini. These elements are covered in the graphic novel Persepolis, which was also turned into a great animated movie. People should check that out. And for the overrated Hollywood side of it, we've got Argo.
Yes, never watched that. Never was interested. That is a movie, though.
It is. It's the very, very white version of the story of the Islamic Revolution. It's so white, it won an Oscar. It is so white, it's Canadian-American. Ben Affleck's character, the guy who he is playing, is shown in photographs towards the end of the movie,
mm-hmm.
and he is the most Puerto Rican guy I've ever seen in my life.
Really?
And I'm Puerto Rican. So
Ben Affleck, same thing, you know, whatever.
Right. Give him the Oscar. So when the Ayatollah took over, what followed was a period known as the Iranian Revolution, when colleges closed for 3 years while the academia of Iran was purged of Western non-Islamic influences to bring it in line with the revolutionary and political Islam. The Iran-Iraq War started in 1980 and ran for 8 years. Iran and Iraq have had border disputes since the Ottoman-Persian Wars. Hundreds of years of conflicts over territorial disputes. It wasn't until modern history that they found a truce in order to stabilize markets and sell oil to the world.
If you were Iran, your country's shaped like a cat. That's how I know which one's Iran. It looks like a cat. Like, why would you want to change your borders? You're a cat.
Right. Well, for the most part, it's Iraq, especially in the modern era. So enter Saddam Hussein and his oil-funded military-industrial mm-hmm. complex. He was looking for more territory with more oil,
right.
and so starts impeding on their borders, and that sort of sparks, you know, a 100-year-old conflict.
Yeah, it's a really long-standing thing, because what happened in Iran previously to the oil was that they had allowed England to come in and take everything for the ability after 100 years. So they signed with England on this. So 100 years later, then we get all the oil and stuff because you've taught us how to do it. But for that 100 years, they were subservient to England as far as the oil goes and as far as the oil company goes, the Iran National Oil Company. Mm. So it's like Khomeini kind of comes in a funny time in that the Shah really, really revolutionized Iran and the Shah's father and that family. But Khomeini was there at just the right time.
Yeah.
United States kind of fucked up.
Yeah.
And helped bring all that together, and then enter Saddam Hussein and this entire war coming in the 80s.
Yeah, so Saddam Hussein trying to take advantage of Iran's revolutionary chaos.
Mm-hmm.
They initiated a surprise attack. Again, they were going after rich oil territories, but it wasn't successful except to start the war. 500,000 Iraqi soldiers and Iranian soldiers died, with an equivalent number of civilians killed. And at the end of the day, nothing changed. The borders are right. the same now as they were before the war. In a particularly vicious wave, Iraq was bombing Tehran, and in the way that the Nazis blitzkrieged England,
mm-hmm.
civilian sites. And so that's where our story takes place. Enter Shideh, the lovely Narges Rashidi, who, the way you feel about Cillian Murphy.
Yeah. This is really.
Wow. Like I did a lot of looking up after this. I was very curious where she's been all my life.
Where have you been? Now, this was made though in the States, or no?
This was made in Jordan, because okay. Iran is still not exactly artist
friendly. Right, exactly.
So she is born in Iran of a Persian descent, but her father was like a commander in the army. They left. They moved to Germany. So she was raised partially in Germany and then in England, I believe. But I'm only positive about Germany. So she's multilingual. She stars in German movies. This
okay.
is all good things I'm finding out.
Oh, good.
I'm Googling.
We should get her to make a movie with Cillian Murphy.
Yeah. Let's
let's do that.
Let's email some people. So enter our family, Shideh, who I've mentioned, Narges Rashidi, her husband, the doctor, Iraj. They're both raising their daughter, Dorsa. She's a cute kid, plays with the other kids in the building patio. Now, before Dorsa was born, her parents were in med school and then became student protesters, or at least Shide did. And present day, her government considers her persona non grata for being one of the upstarts. Now, she wants to go back to med school, but they'll never let her back in. And it is like this crushing heartbreak that she, you know, she kind of took this detour from her life and her husband is essentially doing what she wants to do. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of tension there in that household. That initial heartbreak is made worse when her husband is drafted into the military to serve as a doctor on the front lines. Ew. And so knowing that like the Tehran is being bombed and the husband is now going to be away on the front lines, like this is the kind of, you know, psychological torture that starts chipping away.
Right, right.
So while the city is being bombed on a daily basis, we get a repeat series of visuals of everybody in the building having to evacuate to the basement bomb shelter. You know, they've got air raid sirens going on, and over time in the movie, everybody starts taking off, everybody starts leaving town, okay. And eventually it's just her and Dorsa. So I've already spoken at length about this, and I won't go too much deeper into the story because it's worth discovering for yourself, but it does incorporate the concept of a djinn.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Okay, you're familiar.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I don't know when's the first time I came across the idea. Honestly, I think it was an episode of Supernatural.
Okay, fair enough. I don't know. Maybe the first time was probably that X-Files episode.
Is there an X-Files?
Yeah, they get one.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, David and Company finds one because, yeah, whatever. It's a good episode. You should watch it.
Okay, so for those unaware, there is a 2014 movie called Djinn, which probably fills in some of the gaps. I couldn't speak
it
to
looks
it.
Terrible.
I haven't seen it.
It looks like one of those terrible films.
I haven't seen the trailer
like,
for it.
Kind of one of the ones that I would probably watch.
Well, you watch it, get back to me.
I probably will.
For those who are hearing it for the first time, a djinn is a supernatural creature in early Arabian and later Islamic mythology and theology. In Islamic theology, humans were made of clay, among other things, while djinn are also said to be creatures of free will made from smokeless fire by God himself.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. And so the way they're treated in the book is kind of as if they, with their free will, they will also be judged in the afterlife. So it seems like they're not inherently evil.
But a lot of times they're mischievous as shit.
Yeah, I think that's more the commonplace, but maybe not necessarily, you know, inherently bad.
Right.
They're
not
tricksters.
Like,
they like to play games. And
right.
So,
but they're not like the guy in Aladdin. Like, don't think like the djinn is like the happy genie in Aladdin.
So the djinn is kind of hitched a ride. You know, this boy is essentially cursed and, right. And brings the djinn with him. It's not a huge part. It's just kind of how it makes its way there. Mm-hmm. So I'll leave it there. I will say I like the movie a lot. It's fascinating in terms of like this cultural jump to, you know, while it's made in Jordan, it is made to demonstrate like all Iranian and sort of Persian customs. And we also sort of butt heads in terms of the context of the Islamic Revolution. Mm-hmm. Our main character loves the liberal life she used to live and is incredibly frustrated that she is, you know, remanded to this second class status.
Right, right.
So I loved it and I've got a new favorite actress out of it.
Nice. I'll definitely check it out now. Is it, it's Farsi with English subtitles or
that's
English
right.
language?
Yes. Yeah, it Farsi, is. It is yeah. Farsi.
Okay, great. As always, you can contact us on all the social media. We are on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Rants Macabre.
Yeah, I feel like we've been really busy on social media lately.
I do too. We do a lot of tweeting.
Twittering. Finally, and I'll take a picture when it is final. But Friday is meant to be my last day. As of this recording, it's tomorrow.
You say this every week. Like I think the listeners are kind of like, it's never going to happen, Darren. You're going to be here forever.
And we've joked about how, yes, we're never going to escape. But I was told Friday. I was told I get to leave Friday. They'll let me go. Friday, the curse is broken.
Then you find out, like, what if I try and call you and then you don't answer. And then I find out I have been dead all this time. Can you imagine?
Yeah, there's no cell reception in whatever ethereal plane I'm living in next, or you're living. I lost the plot. we're also on Patreon, where you can find an alternate catalog of material that we're really proud of. There's some great stuff in there between like the Night of the Living Dead, deep dive. We've got Last House on the Left, comparisons between the original and the historical context of that, and the remake, which, you know, was kind of standing on the shoulders of giants, is a great flick. We've got sketches that we're constantly working on. We've got a lot of stuff on Patreon waiting for your buck a month. It's not, yes, not asking a whole lot. And also, if you're feeling charitable, there is the donate button on our website, therantsmacabre.com, where there's always bonus content as well. Yeah, that's everything.
Next week, we have coming up Slimed.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah.
That's crazy. I have a lot of movies I need to watch.
Yes, I am most excited for you to see the remake of The Blob.
Yeah, I'm excited.
You sound it.
Yes, I'm very excited. Can't you tell?
It's entirely a recap of You Can't Do That on Television from the, yes, Nickelodeon days.
And what was that game show that they slimed everybody on?
I knew this. I grew up watching it.
Mark Harmon was the guy, right?
Yeah, the germaphobe.
This is
Double Dare.
I want to leave, right, that long pause in there. Double Dare is definitely the answer.
I love Double Dare.
Because I'm sure the listeners, like, when we try and think and will the thought into the other person's head.
Yeah, I do that all the time on podcasts where they trail off into trying to figure out a thing or maybe misrepresenting a thing.
Right.
Like, you're just kind of – it's everything you can do to not shout it out loud,
exactly,
when you're just alone listening to
this
podcast.
But when I'm editing, I'm like, should I cut this? Should I leave this? What do I do with this?
Yeah, you make a judgment call. Is it funny enough to leave in?
Yeah. Maybe I'll cut half of the time we stared at each other.
Maybe listeners won't even hear this part. On that note, this is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.